In California, U.S. Border Patrol agents are getting sick from cross-border sewage spills in the Tijuana River Valley. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. According to a report in the San Diego Union-Tribune, the number of agents who've become ill has nearly tripled since June. The agents' union had reported 83 illnesses by mid-November, compared to 30 5 months ago. Maureen Cavanaugh of KPBS spoke with reporter Barbara Zaragoza, who's been following this story for the Union Tribune.
When Border Patrol agents say they're getting sick, how have they described their symptoms to you?
Well, when I was down in the Tijuana River Valley with them, some of them are milder symptoms like nasal problems, lots and lots of nasal problems, but others are really disturbing, rashes, really bad rashes on ankles. And then one Border Patrol agent said that he was actually in the hospital for burnt lungs. And what had happened is, I guess there's methane that comes out from feces, and he had breathed that in and then needed to go to the hospital and get antibiotics for treatment, and it was pretty severe.
How are the agents coming in contact with the sewage?
Well, this is interesting, is while I was down there, there had been rain on November 7th, and by November 10th, there was just a large amount of sewage everywhere. And so they're on ATVs, they're in their SUVs, and they're also having to walk around in places like the Tijuana River Channel, and they can't avoid it. It's everywhere. But in addition, what they had told me is once all of that sewage dries, it dries into there's dirt that's dried, and as they drive through it or walk through it, the dust kicks up and then goes into their nasal passages and ends up causing a lot of ear, nose, and throat problems.
One agent you spoke with actually had to stop patrolling on an ATV. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's right. You know, he was a very big guy. He had gone on a tour of Iraq before, so this is not someone who, you know, is used to getting sick. And he had said that he had gotten so sick, and he had been in the ER and the urgent care so many times that he had to get off ATVs and said that his health was more important than being on this prestigious unit, and had to go back to SUVs because of it.
Now, you report that CPB acting commissioner visited the Imperial Beach station this summer to look into the situation. Do you know what came of that visit?
Well, that was reported to me by the union official. He's the secretary of Local 1613, Christopher Harris. And as I was asking him what CBP has done to address this issue, because as we know, from June until now, the number has gone from around 30 to more than 83. I had asked him that, and he explained that the acting commissioner had come and talked to him personally for approximately an hour and 15 minutes, and that he was getting updates. Further than that, I wasn't quite sure.
What, if anything, can the Border Patrol Agency do about this problem?
Well, and that's what Christopher Harris was explaining to me as the union representative, is that he was saying that Border Patrol isn't the EPA. Border Patrol and CBP are not there to really look at issues of contamination. And so the real question is, who is the one who's supposed to oversee this contamination? What organization? Is it the EPA? Is it the IBWC? Should it be Homeland Security? Who does oversee this contamination, and who is responsible for cleaning this up?
Now, when you spoke with the Border Patrol Officers Union, there was some mention that there'd been discussion about building decontamination showers. Do they see that as a solution?
That, as Christopher Harris explained, is that he so far does not see that as a solution because they're not sure what's actually in the water. So he had explained, we don't know what we're decontaminating for, so we can't talk about showers until or we can't talk about decontamination in general until we found out what is in the water. And that's where the International Boundary and Water Commission comes in.
Now, cities in the South Bay, including the city of San Diego, are in the process of taking legal action against the International Boundary and Water Commission for not doing enough to monitor and mitigate these spills. Is the IBWC working on any changes that you know of?
Yes, and that's what I was reporting on, and I was asking the IBWC, specifically Steve Smullen, a lot of questions on that. And he is working with the San Diego Regional Quality Water Board, and they are hoping to start new testing. They're not sure when the testing is going to happen. They would like to add four places because he said the Tijuana channel there that goes behind the Las Americas Mall and several places like Hollister Street and Saturn, where the contamination comes down, where the sewage comes down, is not being tested at all. And he hopes to start testing those.
That was Maureen Cavanaugh of KPBS speaking with reporter Barbara Saragossa. The number of people arrested by the U.S. Border Patrol has dropped to its lowest level in more than four decades. The Department of Homeland Security says the reduction happened during the last fiscal year. Senior policy analyst Joshua Breisblatt at the American Immigration Council says the drop is part of an ongoing trend.
It does not mean CBP is not doing its job. It means that less people are attempting to cross.
Meanwhile, arrests made by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers well inside the borders increased almost 25% at the same time. Just trying to keep up with medical terminology and acronyms during a doctor's visit can be tricky for anyone, and it's especially hard if you don't know the language. KERA's Lauren Silverman reports on a new study of language barriers between patients and doctors and the interpreters working to bridge that communication gap.
Language mix-ups in the hospital can be disastrous. In one high-profile case, decades ago in Florida, a teenager named Willie Ramirez was taken to a hospital in a coma. In describing what they thought happened, family members used the word intoxicado, which usually means intoxicated in English. They meant something entirely different. Ramirez was not on drugs. Turns out he had a brain aneurysm. The miscommunication led to a misdiagnosis and ultimately left him quadriplegic.
All right, I'm just calling you to let you know I have an interpreter available. I will send it to you.
Tucked into a room in the back of Dallas's Parkland Hospital, dozens of medical interpreters like Cruz Ramirez are hard at work making sure language isn't a barrier to medical care. They're explaining diagnoses, giving instructions for surgery, comforting friends and family. It's something they do hundreds of thousands of times each year. Meredith Stiegel is director of language services.
We are the largest program in the country. And this is basically our brain center.
Standing among the cubicles in the language center, Stiegel says nurses and doctors request interpretations hundreds of times a day, 24/7. She says in-person interpretations are provided within 15 minutes of the request, and video and phone interpretations are also available.
We've created an environment for our nurses, physicians, dietitians, social workers, etc., that they know that they are expected to use a medical interpreter, but not just that they are expected to, that it's the right thing and it's the law.
Healthcare providers that receive federal funding, like Medicare and Medicaid, are required to offer language services free of charge. And about 40% of Parkland's patients speak a language other than English. The vast majority speak Spanish. After that,
the top five, Vietnamese, Amharic, Arabic, Nepali, and French. But again, the breadth is insane. And so the challenge is always providing the same quality of care to the person with the rare language as I'm doing with an English speaker or Spanish speaker.
Stiegel says medical interpreters aren't just people who happen to speak two languages. They've gone through intensive cultural and medical training throughout the hospital system.
So this is not like, hi, how are you doing? This is being able to trust that person to explain you have gallbladder cancer.
In an ideal world, Stiegel says, the nurses, the physicians, they would speak the same language as the patients. But most physicians are not multilingual. And even if they are, the second language they speak is often different from that of the patient they're treating. A national study of multilingual physicians was just released by Doximity. It's a social network for healthcare providers. Joel Davis is vice president of strategic analytics.
We certainly found an impressive diversity in the number of languages spoken by doctors across the country. But we also found a language gap between the different languages spoken by physicians and the patients and the populations that they serve.
In Dallas, Spanish and Hindi are the most common second languages spoken by physicians, which matches well with the top languages of patients, Davis says. But there are significant language disparities.
Within the Dallas area, Sub-Saharan and Swahili are the languages where there's the greatest gap between what physicians speak and patients. So there are larger patient populations who speak Swahili and Sub-Saharan African languages compared to doctors who speak those languages.
Doctors who speak Vietnamese are also underrepresented. At Parkland, Meredith Stiegel says they turn to a network of vendors who provide remote interpreters for some rarer languages, like Kinyarwandan, the official language of Rwanda, or Rohingya, a language spoken in Myanmar.
A few months ago, we had a patient who spoke K'iche, which is a fairly rare language from South America. And I called close to 20 vendors trying to find it. And finally, I found one in Chicago who was a qualified medical interpreter for K'iche.
How long might that take?
If it's a rare language, it'll take me about 30 minutes to 2 hours to find a person. All of us that are in this service are kind of in it together. Yeah. You know, people get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to help me find what I need. We all know it's rare. And we all know that if a woman is in labor, you have to have an interpreter for her. You cannot have someone in a situation where there is no one that speaks her language.
In the U.S., there are about 7,000 nationally certified medical interpreters and translators. There are about 25 million people who are limited English proficient, according to census data. Stiegel says long-term, medical schools will have to recruit more students who speak multiple languages. She's also encouraging medical interpreters at Parkland to become physician assistants. So far, a dozen are pursuing nursing school.
For Fronteras, I'm Lauren Silverman.
Coming up on Fronteras, mariachi music makes its way out of the cantinas and into the classrooms.
I hated mariachi when I started. I didn't like it. But now I know this whole book that I just give it to me. Like, I love it. I listen to it every day.
We'll explore that story and a profile of Lupe Valdez, who's the Democrats' biggest hope in challenging Texas Governor Greg Abbott in the next election. It's all coming up when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Dallas County Sheriff Lupe Valdez is running for governor of Texas. Valdez is the daughter of Southwest Texas migrant workers, and she's in her fourth term as sheriff. But Wednesday, Valdez gave up that job to challenge Governor Greg Abbott. Observers say Valdez is the strongest Democratic challenger in the race, but winning the office will be an uphill battle. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports.
After signing her official filing papers at Texas Democratic headquarters in Austin, Lupe Valdez made her announcement.
I'm stepping up. Estoy obligada. For Texas, for everyone's fair shot to get ahead. I'm in.
Valdez framed her run in economic terms, saying she's experienced the struggle to make ends meet that many Texans face. She said her story is proof that education opens doors.
Opportunity in Texas ought to be as big as this great state. But for far too long, hard-working Texans have been left behind, kept out, and frankly, attack for who they are, where they come from, and who they love.
Valdez was first elected Dallas County Sheriff in 2004. In a StoryCorps interview, she said she was a political outsider.
Nobody had ever heard of me. There had never been a minority run for sheriff. There had never been a female run for sheriff. And all of a sudden, I come up with a minority Hispanic lesbian.
Valdez is an Army veteran. She spent decades in federal law enforcement and then decided to launch a political career. But she says challenges are nothing new for her.
I'm the eighth child of migrant workers. You know, I was one of the few that got to go to school, and my family because in the 50s, if you were migrant workers, you didn't get to go to school. You just worked.
When she became sheriff in 2004, Valdez inherited a department with lagging morale and a jail system that was failing health and safety inspections. She turned things around. And over a dozen years in office, her political profile grew. She's publicly tussled with Governor Greg Abbott over immigration, and she was invited to speak at last year's Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
Please welcome Sheriff Lupe Valdez from Dallas, Texas.
Now, with the 70-year-old Valdez running for governor, Texas Democrats can breathe a sigh of relief. University of Houston political scientist Brandon Rodinghouse says the party has been struggling to recruit a strong candidate for the top of the ticket.
Number one, it solves the problem of who's going to run. Number two, it gives them a type of candidate who is perfect to activate the sleeping electorate, younger people, Latinos, liberal Democrats, to come out and vote. And typically that doesn't happen in a midterm election.
Make no mistake, though, getting to the governor's mansion will be really, really hard. Greg Abbott is popular, he's an incumbent, and he's a Republican in a state that hasn't elected a Democratic governor since 1990. Plus, Abbott already has more than $40 million in campaign cash. Cal Gilson from Southern Methodist University says that's about how much Wendy Davis spent on her race back in 2014, and she lost by 20 points.
So Lupe Valdez doesn't necessarily need $40 million, but she needs millions. Tens of millions, really, and she needs a compelling message that she and the Texas Democratic Party can push. It's got to start with education. It's got to include health care and jobs.
Of course, before Valdez can face off with Greg Abbott, there's the Democratic primary to get through. That'll almost definitely include another high-profile candidate, Andrew White. This is Christopher Connolly for Fronteras.
And Valdez is not alone. Businessman Andrew White, son of former Texas Governor Mark White, announced his candidacy for governor as a Democrat on Thursday. You've probably heard it at your favorite Mexican restaurant, or at a Mexican wedding, or at just a really great backyard party. That's the music of mariachis. Mariachi music has expanded beyond the usual haunts. Mariachi programs have blossomed in schools nationwide in the last couple of decades. A long-running mariachi conference in San Antonio is helping foster that growth. I had a chance to visit with some students who were attending the recent 23rd Mariachi Vargas Extravaganza to see what mariachi music means to them. At a mariachi workshop held inside San Antonio's Henry B. Gonzalez Convention Center, the violins were grouped in the right corner. The guitarists took up several rows on the left half of the ballroom, and the trumpets sat some rows back behind the violins. These students come not just from the Alamo City, but from around the country to refine the techniques they've learned in the classroom. Guitarist Ernesto Guerra of Valley View, Texas, has had mariachi running through his veins since he was a child, and an elementary school mariachi program ensured he could keep playing the music he loved.
I started off in fifth grade, and I started off just as normal guitar, and then as I entered sixth grade, I started off with mariachi. So, yeah, I pretty much, like, I already had, like, the mindset of going into the mariachi world. Like, I was already playing, like, one, like, I started off the guitar because I was, like, the only reason how I could get a guitar is because of the mariachi program.
Guitarist Pedro Garcia is a high school student from Hidalgo, Texas. He found himself in similar circumstances as Ernesto. His school didn't have a guitar program, and mariachi was his only option.
I hated mariachi when I started. I didn't like it. But now I know this whole booklet that I just give it to me. Like, I love it. I listen to it every day.
Shayna Welch of Las Vegas, Nevada, shared a similar story. She studied classical violin.
I was actually in orchestra, and because of budget cuts in my school, mariachi was the only thing left that was music, so I wanted to stay in music instead.
She says the program has offered her lots of great opportunities.
Like back in Las Vegas, with my high school group, we were able to back up Gente de Zona. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that band. They're Puerto Rican. we were able to back them up on Desperta America. I was able to attend the Latin Grammys because of that experience. As well as I had the chance to meet Raul de Molina from Gordo y La Flaca because I was able to play on his show and talk to him personally. So I'd have to say that Mariachi really has offered me really cool experiences to meet celebrities.
Carlos Maldonado, a workshop instructor, is with the Mariachi program at Hayes Consolidated Independent School District in San Marcos. The program expanded from one small elementary school class in 2001 to 400 students spanning elementary to middle to high schools across the district. Maldonado says mariachi class gives students a way to forget about their everyday problems.
The mariachi usually, and it's the same for band or choir, that music class, whether it's mariachi, band or choir, it's their sanctuary during the day. You know, that's the one class that, you know, they get up every day to go to.
And that class can take students outside the classroom into a world they never dreamed. That's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced the broadcast. Michelle Dubac is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.